I'm Andrew Ramsamy, and this is the Global Sport Matters podcast. Before we start today, just wanted to remind you that each week we send out our newsletter, packed with the latest stories, events, and podcasts from the Global Sport Matters team. To sign up for our newsletter, be sure to visit our website at globalsportmatters.com and click on the envelope icon on the top right hand of the page. And now, our show. In 1992, Dr. Fitz Hill began his collegiate football coaching career as an assistant coach at the University of Arkansas. In 2001, he became the first black head football coach at San Jose State University. As he progressed throughout his career, Hill was aware that his story was an uncommon one. In his book, Crackback, Hill incorporates his own research and personal experiences to provide insight to the racist hiring practices that plague collegiate athletics. To this day, collegiate coaching staffs across the country are disproportionately white. In a recent study conducted by the Global Sport Institute, the data indicates that coaches of color are systematically prevented from being promoted to head coach positions despite their experience and qualifications. Hill recalls thinking that a tipping point had been reached when the NFL implemented the Rooney Rule and made efforts to diversify coaching staffs. He hoped that this would be mirrored in collegiate athletics, but it seems that the transformation has yet to take place. Joining us in this episode of the Global Sport Matters podcast is Ken Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute, Bill Roden, writer at large for The Undefeated, and Fitz Hill, executive director of the Scott Ford Center for Entrepreneurship Community Development and Foundation at the Arkansas Baptist College. This is the Global Sport Matters podcast.
Fitz, well, it's good to see you again. And
yes, sir.
The great Bill Roden. Used to be my friend. We used to communicate with some great frequency. Now we...
It's been years. It's been years. Thank God for the podcast.
only via podcast do we communicate.
You blame it on the pandemic. That's what everybody's doing now. Oh, man, it was a pandemic.
And we have our great intervener, moderator, referee, Andrew Ramsamy, the only one who really understands how you're supposed to conduct a podcast to keep us in order when need be. You know, Fitz, I did go back for those of you who are on the podcast and can't see this. I did go back and began to read your book again. And, you know, we talked recently and you said something that, and it struck me right away. Essentially, you said, and you wrote this, you finished writing when
2012. And I was telling, I never thought we'd need another book. Mark and I, you know, we've been talking quite a bit, and, you know, and I specifically talked to Mark on a regular basis because, you know, he gave me a balance, and he always told me, stay in the numbers, Fitz, because I was so emotional about it because right. I had been affected by it. So, but he said, you don't have to holler at anybody. You don't have to scream at anybody. And even my dissertation chair, who was a math guy, said, the numbers don't lie, and together they tell a story. Lay the facts out there and back it up. And that's the reason I went with Mark to be able to write that story. And Mark, you know, he was a very interesting reporter that was fair when I was at San Jose State. And he even brought this topic up. He had brought Coach Walsh. You know, we did a topic about it when Doug Williams had the Grambling game. And you know, I realized in that book in 2012 when we published it, I was telling Bill, I thought in 2020 that was just going to be a historical analysis of the bridges we had to cross and the barriers we had to overcome for the production that I thought was going to take place for Black coaches. Nowhere in the day did I think that we would be here having this conversation in 2020. I am dumbfounded.
And that's the broad issue that I think about when I think about this, Fitz. I mean, I was fortunate enough to, I think the first version of your work I read was actually the dissertation. You know, I don't think I read the book until later on. And you know, and Bill, you're the king of the fraternity. You know, Fitz, you're in it too. We've been watching this for so long, and I think it is like it is sort of the old. You know, when I was a kid, I say this sometimes. Integration hadn't happened yet. The Civil Rights Bill had not been passed yet. And there was such a buildup within me as a, you know, 10, 11 year old, whatever I was, that I thought that was the moment. That once we get integration, once we have a Civil Rights Bill, it's going to be done. I don't even know now. And I guess some maturity because, it, you know, I realized it didn't happen. I don't even know now when we'll be there in terms of Black coaches. You know, when will we, and there's not even a beacon out there to turn the corner. I mean, at the pro side, you have the Rooney Rule that hadn't done it. You know, the college side, you know, we talk about the Bill Russell Rule and the Eddie Robinson Rule, sort of all these different things. But I don't even know what you could do. I mean, let's start us off the lowest note possible. I don't even know what you could do to turn the corner. There is no civil rights bill. There is no 64 Act to turn around the hiring practices regarding Black men in college and pro football, which we'll get to a little bit too.
In college, if you go into the last chapter, when I tell you to give you points that I would, based on my research, the only way that I think we can go to a transformational hiring process, and that's what we had to be transformational, is the boosters have to get out the hiring process. It's the same way that we hire presidents and deans. If we hire head football coaches the same way, that's when the process will change, Ken. But until then, take, for example, June Jones, great, good friend of mine. You know, when I was coaching San Jose State, talked to June at the WAC meetings probably more than anybody. We just had some coaches you jive with, you know, and you talk to. June was able to leave Hawaii and come to SMU because of boosters. How did that happen? They got 20 boosters who gave $100,000 each for $2 million. All right. That was the reason that happened. The administration didn't have a whole lot to do with that. That was all the athletic directors and the boosters. They said, we wanted June Jones. Well, that circumvented their hiring process. So that process couldn't have been fair and equal because they knew who they wanted and they were going to pay that money. Now, was he the best guy for the job? Based on production, yes. But how many other opportunities to be interviewed were denied because of a predetermined group that decided we want June Jones and we're only going to pay our money if we get June Jones. So until you change that process, you're exactly right. We will get what we keep getting because the boosters come into play of hiring head football coaches, and probably the football and basketball coach are probably the only really true revenue generating source that takes place. There's probably no other position on a college campus that is employed like the football and basketball coach. And until that process has changed, we will not make substantial progress. We will, as I was telling Bill a while ago, we hit the tipping point, but we went down. And that's the demise of the hiring process or why our numbers have declined rather than continue to improve.
Why was the fit so, there's so much that you just said there. Let's start from the high point of Black coaches. There were still boosters involved there. What changed then when there was a high point of the peak of Black coaches? And I guess you give me the numbers, but when there was a peak of Black coaches, boosters were still involved, the same part. Why was there, what happened? Was there an awakening of consciousness or why then?
Well, if you go back and in the book, I talk about the hiring of Tyrone Willingham, okay? We realized Tyrone, when he was hired at Notre Dame, it was a reaction because they had messed up the process. When they had hired a coach from Georgia Tech
George O'Leary. Yeah.
George O'Leary, who had had falsified on his resume, all right? There's always, you know, and there's a recruiting aspect of it. When I got hired, I had a relationship with Kelly McGregor, who was president of the Colorado Rockies. And those relationships, oftentimes, we don't have. The reason I thought that we were moving toward the tipping point was because the NFL at the time was being so progressive and moving so significantly with numbers, bringing coaches in, getting a minority fellowship. I worked too, the Dallas Cowboys and Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and you saw, you know that the NFL was being more progressive. And so I think the reason, Bill, to answer your question, that we saw more Black coaches being hired, because it was like basketball. When John Thompson and Coach Richardson, when those people were successful, that's a key point now that we haven't had. And I want to be very transparent about that. We haven't had a Black head football coach win a national championship. Right. When that happens, I think we'll create a tsunami. But it hadn't happened. All right. And so, you know, but John Thompson, Nolan Richardson, you saw things change because of the recruiting aspect of it. I mean, think about now Patrick Ewing being at Georgetown, the legacy he's living. Those things carry a lot of weight right now. But the recruiting aspect has a lot to do with it. I know Coach Bill McCartney, he was really, really pushing. That's the reason the Colorado has really been proactive in hiring coaches of color in Boulder, Colorado. And when he won a national championship, the coaches that he had brought there to recruit the Boulder to win a national championship, they realized having a person of color going into the living room helped. But as I shared with Ken a few weeks ago, I'm really at a loss. And I mean, I don't like to sit here and act like I know everything. I haven't studied it the way I had early on, and the way like I am now, because I've been re-inspired, because I'm shocked that we're sitting here with three Black head football coaches in the NFL and the demise of the Black coaches in college. And I was mentioning to Bill earlier that I think in 2015, when Texas and Texas A&M both had Black head football coaches, that's when I think everything kind of went down, because nobody talked about it anymore. I was on the campus. I took my son to Coach Strong's football camp when he was in ninth grade. And I was sitting there talking to many staff members. They were talking about my book. And I said, I hope you all realize that following the 2015-14 football season, I said, there was not one Black head football coach hired. That was the first time in years. And they just looked. Well, no, it wasn't on anybody's radar. Well, Bill mentioned it. You know, I think everybody thought the struggle was over and there was no conversation. You hardly heard any writings about it at that point. Now the writings are coming back. We're having this conversation. And so I guess we have to, you know, reinvigorate this struggle to bring awareness, because I think everybody thought that the whole thing was fixed.
You know, this is what's clear to me. And I must tell you, man, I don't even watch college football. I can't watch it. And it's strictly, I can't, because it, to me, and Ken and I, we've talked about this before. It is the epitome of the plantation system, you know, where you got all these young brothers. But what I'll suggest to you, or at least I'll ask you, Fitz, see, I don't think this thing changes at all. I don't think it changes all until the labor, the raw material, these young Black kids and their nutty parents, these Black kids and Black players do what we did like in the 50s. We will not, we won't spend where we can't work. And until that attitude, I think, catches on with these, all the raw material that forms when young Black stars and their parents say, listen, we are not going to continue to go to schools where there are no white coaches, haven't been white coaches, haven't been white athletic directors. To me, when a few guys over a few years say that, that's the only thing that gets people's attention. But I don't know, Fitz, you can tell me, it just seems like the mentality of our kids and of their parents is that we don't care about that, man. We just got to get, we want to get that scholarship. We want to play in Bear and Bama Stadium. Or we want to play. It seems like the consciousness that you're expressing is just totally non-existent. So what do you think about that?
Well, two things. You can take basketball. Howard University just got four or five star player. I think basketball has a greater opportunity to do that than football. Why? Because I think your point's right on, and I used to say this all the time. If Gonzaga can be a top five program, so can Howard in basketball. So I think that's your quickest way to change the process in basketball. The Fab Five we talked about, they went to Michigan. What if the Fab Five went to Howard? What if the Fab Five went to Southern? What if the Fab Five went to Grambling? Well, they said, well, why they won't? Well, you know, the facilities and the TV contracts. But to your point, if you're winning, the contracts, the TV, they're going to follow you. And in basketball, that happens. In football, that can't happen because of the football championship series and FBS. Now, is there one program that we can take that can possibly become that? I think Jackson State, think prime time may be that because, as he said, they already joined 35 to 40,000. If you go back and look from NFL players, Jackson State historically has put as many players in the NFL, you know, as other schools. So that might could happen, but it will take a concerted effort because, you know, have you seen the locker room at Alabama?
Yeah, but hey, but Fitz, I'm not suggesting that they go to black schools. I'm just saying if some of your high profile stars say we want to play for black coaches, whether it's the five black coaches of the Pac-10 or the three in the Big Ten or the one in the right. SEC or the one. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying when they make a big deal, we want to play for black coaches and you have high profile kids saying that, you know, I think that's almost the only thing that's going to shift the balance.
And I think Texas and Texas A&M, you know, when Coach Sumlin beat Alabama, you know, I think they thought they had made the turn. Charlie, Coach Strong only got 3 years, and that's something we talk about in the book. You know, you don't get the time to build the program. You know, when Mack Brown was at North Carolina the first time, you know, you get more time. So I think oftentimes, you know, when you look at Texas, Texas A&M, what people saying now, well, we have been fair. You know, they didn't get the job done. So I think that's what people will throw your rebuttal out there. But but your point's well taken. Why Arizona State and Arizona doesn't become a powerhouse? I mean, Stanford, you know, when you're looking at it, you know, Vanderbilt is not dealing, you know, that's not comparing apples to apples. He's doing the very best he can. But the Big 12 has zero. I mean, not one African-American head football coach in 2020 in the Big 12. I mean, yeah, in the Big 12. Think about that.
Right. I'll tell you.
I mean, I'm lost for words. I really don't know what to say. I'm honest because, you know, rarely am I caught without words, you know, based on my research. I have no words. When I looked at that data and I saw that there is not, you know, and I'm not, so there's nobody qualified to coach in the Big 12. I don't know.
I got the word is racism and white supremacy. I mean, this isn't really complicated. I mean, we can make it. We have another 45 minutes to fill here, but it ain't really complicated. It's racism and white supremacy, you know, and couple that with a lack of consciousness among, you know, young black kids choosing colleges and their crazy ass parents. But okay. Having said that, let's fill it out, Ken.
No. Bill, I don't think I've ever shared this with you. Every time you call a college campus a plantation, and I usually disagree with you, I say that's, you know, not that I'm up for the Uncle Tom or the Year Award, because I mean, I got a long way to go.
The winner is from the crime from the Global Sports Institute.
Hey, I'm working out. We'll call it the Tommy Award. So that's a whole other story. But back again, when I was at Stanford, this is validating your point to some extent. All of us were recruited. There were 10 black guys on the team, whatever, 7, 8, whatever, out of, you know, 80, whatever the rosters were then. And the black guy that recruited us, because as Fitz says so well in the book, especially then, if you had a black guy, he was as talented as he may be, he was the recruiter.
Yeah.
So we all came and we got there my first year, and he was gone. So there were no black coaches. And so we were really, unless you were the superstar coming in, you were lost, unless you were, you know, Tony Hill and some other kind of name guys. So you mentioned Ray Anderson was on the team. I was a freshman, and Ray said, okay, you're going to be hosting the black kids as they come in. Make sure you tell them to ask the white coaching staff about hiring a black coach. And a couple of them went to the extreme as they did that. We told them, you know, there's no black coach and they won't be one unless you ask for it. And then a couple of them went to the extreme of saying, I'm not coming here because there's not a black coach. And when I tell you that coaching staff called us in, and I mean, these guests were so emotional. Well, damn it, we're going to get a black coach. Stop doing that to our recruits. And they ended up hiring, I mean, in rapid succession, Willie Shaw.
Wow.
So Willie came and was special teams, and he kind of worked his way through, and Willie became Willie. I take as much credit as I can. If not for Will that moment, there'd be no David Shaw at Stanford. I mean, but you just don't know what the impact is of those kinds of moments. And I don't know that, you know, Bill, you're asking for a lot, although, you know, historically, we kept yearning for 68 to come again for that kind of activity. Now, we've never had kind of that activity in college at full blown. Well, we did, actually, if you think about it. I mean, that's when the Wyoming guys, the guys up at Syracuse. I mean, so there was quite a bit of activity at one point. So it's not impossible. And it's not, you know, the other thing, you know, the one word that I want to inject in the conversation is that pipeline word. I mean, that becomes, at the pro level and the college level, the biggest defense in some ways that the powers that be put in place. Well, let's work on the pipeline.
Yeah, right.
And I in my conversations, in those settings, I ban the use of the word pipeline, because somebody smart me once said, it's the oldest excuse in the world, and it's not valid.
You know, I think if you want to, I want to give credit to Coach Bill McCartney though, as a way of, and I write about this in the book, because I recruited against him in Dallas and in Carter and Kimball High School when they were putting together this national championship team. And I saw then what inclusion, not just diversity, inclusion will do. When his assistant head coach, and I'm telling you, I remember vividly, I was the only African-American coach on the staff of Arkansas in 1993. Coach McCartney, I was recruiting one of the top players out of Dallas. And I remember a car pulling up big, that just flew in, big Cadillac, pulled into the five brothers, got out the car. And you want to know why they won a national championship? Because back to your point, they were taking five African-American coaches into a room. And Coach McCartney understood the power of that in Boulder, Colorado, which was 2% white. I mean, 2% black, the whole deal. But he recruited a national championship, bringing kids from New Orleans, Dallas, San Diego, all to Boulder, Colorado. And he had a plan to do that by being inclusive of his coaches. And he's been an advocate of black coaches ever since, because he realized that. And you would think, Bill, Ken, Andrew, you would think that model would steer you to, man, having a coaches of color all the way across and going into the room, back to what Ken was talking about. I had to go to, and I write about this in my book, I was the only black on the staff at Arkansas in 93. I went in and asked Coach Danny Ford to hire another black coach. Now, I went in very uncomfortable. In 1993, as a 27-year-old African-American coach, only black on there, and rather looking at that, which some of our black coaches look at that as job security, I realized that our black players needed more role models than just me, because if you're wrong, I'm gonna get on you, and you need a good cop and a bad cop when you're trying to develop our young men. So I went in and I'm gonna tell you, this is how the conversation went. When I went to Coach Ford, I said, Coach Ford, we just had a coach leave. I said, I want to recommend that we hire another African-American football coach. Well, to Coach Ford, who had played for Coach Bear Bryant, that really struck him because he had never only had one black coach on his staff. All right. And so he said, well, Nebraska doesn't have more than one. I said, no, coach, they got three. Turner Gill, Ron Brown, I said, all of them. I said, I recruit against them. I said, that's how they just won a national championship. I said, I'm the only one here. I said, we need another. Well, I had to change his mindset. And so I had to educate him on the value. Now, think about this. In 1983, a 27-year-old African-American coach is educating a white male on the value of inclusion and diversity for recruiting. And I told him why. I said, let me tell you why. I said, I just left Kimball, and the coach told me, high school coach told me, that he would not let his player come to Arkansas because I was the only black on the staff, and they perceived me to be a token. Hmm. That was the story. It's in the book. All right. So I said, I'm just telling you. Now that story allowed me to go tell him the truth. I said, so if we want to go out and recruit in urban communities in Northwest Arkansas, we need to diversify our staff. And he went and hired David Mitchell from Syracuse because of that conversation. So as you said, we have to be proactive in bringing it to the table, because if I would have said nothing, maybe nothing would have been thought of.
I'll tell you one thing we decided at the Global Sports Institute is, and you can mentally feel like this is not the right thing to do, but we have decided that we are going to try to more formally write up the business case for diversity and inclusion in sport. I think a lot of us that have been engaged in this for a while just steer away from that. Like, why would we have to make a business case for that? But you gave one great example there, Fitz. You know, in the book, you even more intimate. You mentioned a couple of examples. You mentioned a kid at Northwestern State that was about to be thrown off the team. You recall that?
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, yeah.
Why don't you tell that story?
Kid from New Orleans, and we had no blacks on the staff there. I was two GAs. And it's just amazing how God was using all these dynamics to shape why I said we have to speak up. But they were going to kick the best football. He went up, get drafted, went on to the NFL. But one of the coaches, he bucked up at the coach in there, but the coach had no relationship with him. And so he said, you go to the room. You go to the room. We'll talk to you later. So they call a coaching staff meeting, and we sit right there in the coaching staff meeting. And he said, he's defense coordinator. He said, I want Randy Hilliard off the team. He said, he's disrespectful, he's dishonorable. I said, and me and the other black coach said, coach, he's never been like that to us. I said, you know, he's always done everything that we've said. Then we said, what is your relationship with him? Have you talked to him? I said, you know, you just went up and grabbed him and told him to do this. And I said, he doesn't have that relationship with you. And I said, and the other coach spoke, we've been checking curfew. We've been doing everything. We haven't had yes, sir, no, sir to us. And we're graduate assistants. And had we not been in there, we know he was going to be put off the team, because until we stood up for him in that staff room, there was nobody else advocating for him but two black GAs. You know, and he's an NFL caliber player. And you got to have, you know, when I'm working with young men here, you have to have people, when they make bad decisions, you have to have people to advocate for them, but you have to be able to mentor to them as well. That's why when you go around and you look at the staffs that are doing well, the relationships that you have to be able to coach guys hard and do the things for them, you have to have those relationships off the field as well as on the field. And you know, I'm not saying, I'm gonna tell you who the best though. I had it. I'm not saying a white coach can't do it, because Houston Nutt, probably the best I've ever seen to go into a black home and make everybody feel comfortable. I remember saying, hey, you know, Houston said, we got to get BET in Northwest Arkansas. That's the first thing he said, you know, when he came there. We didn't have BET. He knew the value of BET in Northwest Arkansas, you know, in 1998. Because, you know, and he said, look, what, you know, he made me recruiting coordinator. He said, Fitz, we're going to do everything we can to get BET in 1998 in Northwest Arkansas. So all those little things matter, you know, to being able to be inclusive. And if you're, you know, look, and there are great white coaches, but I'm saying, why do black coaches not get an opportunity? I mean, Bear Bryant wasn't born a head coach. Mm-hmm. He had to be given an opportunity. Nick Saban wasn't born a head coach. He had to be given an opportunity. Coach Shaw wasn't born a head coach.
But, you know, it seems to me, though, I'm typically an optimistic person until it comes to this, because it's so disheartening. Again, I keep going back to the mentality of, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I forgot who made the point. I don't know if it was you or Ken, that maybe you, it is a lot. It's a lot to expect for a 19-year-old kid, his family, who's going to, you know, look into maybe the first one going to college, or, you know, who wouldn't want to go to Stanford or play at Alabama or whatever. So maybe it is a lot to expect, but I don't know, do you think, Fitz, in this time of Black Lives Matter, you know, that maybe there'll be some consciousness, because there are 13 black coaches to choose from. I mean, it's not like they don't exist, you know, and I'm wondering if maybe as coaches, maybe the coaches need to become more militant. Maybe the coaches need to become more demanding, because it seems sometimes, and you could speak to this mindset, you don't want to rock the boat, you know, you don't want to, you know, be cast as a militant. Maybe you don't want to form an organization, but that's something John Thompson did. He didn't mind doing that. John Thompson didn't mind rocking the boat and rattling the cages and let everybody know this is a problem. And what do you think about, the black coaches doing more playing offense and not playing defense as much as they seem to be playing?
Well, here's what research says. All right. The power to ignite the struggle is with the black athlete. Always has been, and that will be how things will change. So many times, you realize now from in 1960, this is kind of like a sociology problem too. In 1960, 80% of the black homes, when you keep talking about the parents, were led by men, okay? Today, only 30%. And sometimes that mama is so involved in trying to keep that household together, she may not be involved in the young man's life. So the head football coach becomes that person. When that, like I told you, when I went to Dallas, when I went to Kimball talking to the head coach, he told me, and I'm not sending my boy, nobody in my school is coming to Arkansas because you're the only black on there and we perceive you to be a token. All right. Mama didn't know anything about that. That head football coach, that head high school coach is the daddy for most of our kids today. So that power struggle or that power infusion of social movement has to come from the high school coaches, because the high school coaches now, in many cases, that is the father. Very rarely will you go to a two-parent home. It just doesn't happen today, unlike the 1960s when Coach Rob was recruiting and you were going there and kids were going to church and you had that culture. Our lives has changed so over the last 50 years. And things have, you know, crime is so rampant. And sometimes you're going into, I was going to New Orleans one time recruiting, and the drug dealer one told him it was okay for me to come in the community. that's how bad it is. He good, you know. So because they realize what, you know, you're trying to help somebody, all right. So I think the high school coaches, Bill, is really the tool, because just like that coach told me, I had ammunition to go back and tell Coach Ford. Then what happened? We hired another coach. Now, how can we make this in my era? In my deal, how, you know, somebody said, well, Fitz, you had a chance. You went to San Jose State and you wasn't successful. I said, yeah, you're right. I wasn't. I did get an opportunity, you know, and I was blessed with that opportunity. But most people, as Ron Brown told me when he went to interview for the position at Brown College, most time that's what he played, you know, in the Ivy League. And he's been very successful in Nebraska, helping win national championship. They consider him an experiment where you play. So now if your own school won't hire you, you know, then you have to look at different ways that you can process how we can break through this hiring process, which is not inclusive, Bill. That's the thing about it is, and you know, the Rooney Rule, the Rooney Rule is made because nobody's inclusive. So they're gonna say, well, you got to hire one. You know, the Eddie Robinson Rule that Dr. Lapchick always talk about. I mean, why do you do it? And another conversation I was sharing with the group two or three weeks ago, I mean, do you realize we keep saying the first? I didn't realize what that meant. I was sharing with Ken now. That has really overwhelmed me to say when you somebody introduce you as the first. In 2020, you know how many programs have not hired a Black coach?
Yeah.
I mean, that really is deafening.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but the reality is that that coaching has become welfare for white coaches, you know, and it is, it's welfare. It's become welfare for white coaches. And that's not going to, if you look at it, you know, you got your one shot, but these guys, there's a whole network of guys, man. Again, it is literally welfare. You know, you get hired, when then you get your guy picks you up somewhere else. And it just, it's very, and it's incest. So you got the combination of welfare and incest, and it's a very difficult, you know, I mean, we're acting like we're appealing to morality, but this is not, this is not a moral question, man. You can't,
we got plantations. We got incest. I forgot the one, but incest caught me there for a minute.
Yeah, incest and white, well, coaching welfare, is welfare for white coaches. But tell me, either any of you, what's not right about that? Now, be careful, Ken, or else we'll give you that award on Monday. See, I went to an HBCU. Go ahead. Go ahead. We won't go down that road. Go ahead.
But you know what? I mean, it is, I mean, this all goes back to the same thing. You know, those who have the power have the opportunity to share the spoils. So if we have, you know, 100 plus white coaches in those positions in college now, and only a dozen African-Americans, and we have the kind of culture that we have in this society that people tend to hire people that look like themselves, that's the nature of the business. But I want to Fitz, you can certainly answer that too, but I do want to get to the pro question too, because I think there is a real connection. Matt Rule, which is very interesting. You think the last time there's been an African American that's gone from college to the pros, and what it would take to have that opportunity, as Fitz was saying, is the complexity is you got to have a good team to go there, and you can't just have every hiring season. Well, David Shaw doesn't want to go.
You have a bunch
of guys that are ready to go. So we've got that missing piece, and that's one time where I think you can talk about pipeline and talk about a reasonable kind of way. You know, I'm just thinking, you know, to the past couple of days, past couple of weeks at the pro level, we've seen two Black interim head coaches name. And I don't know what that means. I don't know what I think about that. Romeo Crennel at the Texans, and then Raheem Morris at Atlanta. And I don't know if that's a metaphor for anything. I mean, if you look at the history of interim head coaches, I mean,
remember what I was saying. Anytime that you, it's kind of like Tyrone going to Notre Dame, a bad situation always usually is the best opportunity for a person of color. All you got to do is look at the day.
Interim by
day. Yeah, because listen, here's the deal. Here's the deal. Think about that. What's your locker room is probably 80% African American in the NFL. So how are you going to go talk to those? I mean, nobody could have got on the on ESPN, but what Mike Singletary said, I'm not going to put up with it. I'm not going to tolerate it. I'm not going to have it. Only Mike Singletary could have done that. So when you have to have somebody who people that what I call identifiable role models, that you can put somebody in check, that you can walk them, they said, we have a shared experience. That's the sociology issue behind placing that person in that difficult situation. You know, the best situations, we rarely get. That's why I was saying when that happened at Texas and Texas A&M, man, everybody thought we had reached the mountaintop. All right. And so the struggle decreased. All right. So in NFL right now, but I think back to your point, I can't think of his name, but you know, you have a guy who's fired at Texas Tech, he gets the head job in NFL. You get, yeah. You know, Matt, you know, so those things happen too when what reason would you think, and I'll call his name here in a minute, that the young man from Texas Tech could go from being terminated in college to being successful in the pros. Those are things that never happen to people of color.
And we're right. Talking about Cliff Kingsbury? Is it?
Yes, Cliff Kingsbury. That's exactly. So think about that now. Yeah. Now, you know, that's why I used to say race defines space for black coaches.
I'm throwing a couple other names in the mix and a couple other examples across sports. We mix metaphors, and then Bill's going to straighten all this out for us. I mean, Dusty Baker taking over the Astros. Good team, right. Bad situation.
Yeah. Built for stress. We're built for stress. We are. Our whole lives. We're used to bad situations. So, you know, how are we going to look at it? Or somebody going to walk in and give you a head coaching job? You're going to say, no, that's too tough for me. No, you realize I may not. But, hey, I didn't even apply for the job at San Jose State. The athletic director flew down to Northwest. I wasn't going out there. I mean, that wasn't the job I wanted. But when he gave it to me and I talked to people, they said, you mean you're going to turn down a head coaching job? He said, it was only four then. He said, you realize blacks don't get these opportunities? You know, I said, you got to be out your mind. So I took the job, you know.
And what you recall what San Jose's record was when you took the job?
They had won that year before. But they had some tension with the athletic director, and so it wasn't a good situation for he was really under a little pressure to hire a coach, and so I kind of lessened the pressure for him. But they hadn't been to a bowl in several years.
What was that like? You were hired in 2000, tough first year. What was that like being an assistant so many years? And I know we want to jump back to the NFL, but being an assistant so many years and finally getting your head coaching job, what was that transformation like?
Well, I'd already been, you know, put together what I was going to do, being that I was assistant head coach for 3 years. It's like anything else. If you have great players, you're going to have a chance to win. And I knew I had recruited California a little bit to junior colleges, and I thought I could be successful in doing it. And, you know, the plan worked. And, 2 years after I left, they win 10 games. So, and I was happy to see that because in many cases, people think you come in and you kill the program. In fact, Mark Purdy texted me and said, when they played in the New Mexico Bowl with 10-2 record, all your players are starting. 19 of 22 year players on the field, you know. So I knew the game plan of recruiting would work. It's just getting that opportunity. The thing that I think that was really a moment, an eye-opening moment for me was in 1993. I had my best team. And, you know, sometimes you lose. And we lost four games by a total of 11 points, and we lost all four of them in the last 2 minutes of the game. Just crushed me, you know. So, and we should have been better. I own that. But we're at our little event. Our booster event, no black boosters in the room. And, I think you get minimum $5,000 contributor. So coaches have to be there. A lot of wine, a lot of drinking going on. And one of the boosters have been drinking. And, you know, when they're drinking, he didn't hold his tongue. He came up to me, you know, He said, you know, we was over there talking to a group of guys, coach, and boy, you done a great job recruiting, and we really think though, if you had fewer black coaches on your staff, you'd have won more games this year. That's what he told me. I said, really? Now, long time ago, before the Lord changed my heart, I probably would have responded totally different. But I said, did you check the coaches, the previous coaches, that their 3 years that they've been here, that I've been here now, what our winning percentage was? He said, no, I didn't think you did. I said, you realize I've been more successful than those coaches in my tenure here than in the same period of time? He just looked at me. He said, no, I didn't realize that. I said, I know you wouldn't. I said, because I know that you equate blackness based on your conversation, my skin color, with being unqualified. And you base white skin color on being qualified. I said, that's not fair to either one of us. I said, I know I own responsibility that we should have won more games this year. I said, but I don't think it's a color association. He didn't know what to say. But see, that's the boosters.
Right.
And I told the athletic director, I said, listen, I probably wouldn't be good for me to talk to him again. I said, because I didn't want to embarrass anybody that night, because I owned that season. But those are type of things that happen. And I told him, I said, you never would have said that to a white coach when you're used to seeing one black assistant on the sideline. And with my staff, I had four. All right. And so to him, we're not qualified. That's really the stereotypical perception that we're dealing with today of hiring black coaches.
Did you think Black Lives Matter? I mean, Ken had mentioned Romeo Crennel and Raheem and where was he in? Not Jacksonville, but
Kareem Morris
at Atlanta. Did you think that this climate may change things? I mean, you know, for those two guys, I mean, Romeo's a great guy. Number one, he's just a great guy. Raheem, why do I keep calling him Raheem? But do you think that it's going to change? Do you think the atmosphere will change?
In NFL, I'm just still, and Ken, you may have some thoughts about this. The loss of head football coach in NFL just puzzled me, because they were so aggressive and creating such a climate back in the early 2000s. Ken, what's your thoughts on that?
I think you said it earlier. It's taking the foot off the pedal. You stop watching it for a minute and then it changes. So it is likely to bounce back this hiring season. If not, because that's happened before, you know, 5-6 years ago, it was an over kind of hiring season as well. In terms of the number of black coaches for jobs that are available. So, I think if it happens again this hiring season, and I tell you that there's a lot of work, again, for my Uncle Tom Award, there's a lot of work going on with the NFL internally trying to figure this out at the league level, which is only part of the answer. How do you get that down to the teams? But if it happens again this hiring season, and Bill's kind of raising it, I don't know if the Raheem and Romeo are signals of what might be happening, or if they just happen to be, frankly, the guys who had been head coaches that are sitting on the staff, and it's a kind of opportunistic moment or not. So I would reserve judgment a little bit. But I think what has to happen is you can't take your foot off the pedal this time. If it goes back up, you got to find ways to sustain that kind of pressure to keep it happening. Because, you know, one thing we're discovering, you know, again, this is my 64 Civil Rights Act kind of moment. It's not a moment. I mean, and when is it going to change? I don't know. And I always, kind of ask in these settings, when do we know we're there? And, mm-hmm. you know, The people used to love to give the colorblind answer. Now we know that's, you know, really not, that's not right. We want people to recognize positively everybody's differences. So what will it take to actually get there? I don't know, but I think with the NFL, we've got another moment of inflection to occur. If it doesn't occur, then Fitz, I'm almost exactly like you've been a couple of times today. Like the college thing, you almost throw your hands up in the air and say, well, I don't know what to do. And then Bill gave us a pretty succinct answer. Racism, white supremacy, sort of all those sorts of things really do, you know, and the problem for people listening to this, you know, we fight this a lot. And Fitz, you mentioned this in your book a couple of times. When you try to figure out why didn't I get the job, and you go through every element, and the one thing that's on your list that you can't reckon for is race, and you don't want to say it's race. You want to try to find that there's something else, but every now and then you just got to come back and say yes, it's race.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm just curious. What's been the reaction? What was the reaction to your book? I mean, were people inviting you on speaking engagements and coming to speak to white groups, the Coaches Association, and, you know, to kind of preach the word, or did they act like it didn't exist? What was the reaction?
Well, you know, I had a lot of people here asked me not to even write the book, and thought that in fact, me being in my position, wonder why would I write a book? But you know, I have 28 years of research from my thesis to my dissertation, you know, to meeting Dr. Lapchick and making presentations with him throughout the country, to realize that I knew that I wanted to write the book. I think there were, you know, at the time, go back to it, Bill, at the time when you actually featured the book in the New York Times, that I was seeing progress, and I was thinking, man, my book helped champion that. And, you know, from 2012, then particularly, you know, when I went to Texas and I took my son to University of Texas to Coach Strong football camp, I felt like I was a part of that educational movement that wrote about this, you know, because when I was the head football coach at San Jose, I played Florida and Charlie was the defensive coordinator. And so we talked after the game. And so, you know, having those type of conversations and to see him and Kevin Sumlin at Texas A&M, I thought that I had maybe, you know, I educated people to the barriers that restricted African-American from getting head coaching jobs. So now that's why I said, I'm really baffled, guys, about that process, that decline of that. And, you know, some people, I even mentioned NCAA. I used to go speak to the NCAA. I don't want to talk about that a whole lot, but it's in the book. You know, they didn't invite me back one time after I went up and made a presentation, you know, because I used to speak to all the groups, but there was a specific person didn't like my presentation. Because I was talking to coaches and I was telling them how to go about presenting themselves and what, you know, I can almost tell you, because black coaches still call me when they get ready to interview for jobs, I can pretty much ask them 4 or 5 questions if they're a legitimate candidate or not based on the experiences of coaches. So I say, did so-and-so call you? No. Did the athletic director ask you who you're gonna hire on your staff? I said, no. I said, well, if they didn't ask a black coach what staff member they're going to bring with them, because that's the first thing the boosters want to know. If I bring a black coach, who is he bringing with him? You know, because oftentimes, just as that booster said to me, he thought I had a soul train on the line over there when I was coaching. That's, you know, that was the perception that I was starting a soul train. So, you know, there were many at that time, but at the time, things were so much better than what they were today. I think we were hitting almost 20, 21 coaches to be head coaches in FBS at the time. And now that we're down to 13, you know, that this is not, man, I'm lost for words. I really don't know.
Why don't we start to wrap this up, and let's strive to find an up note to do so. Not by me getting the Tommy Award. We'll find some other path. But I do. I mean, the one glimmer that you did put out there, Fitz, is the systematic way in which people need to be hired. That potentially is a path of change.
That
it is a more traditional hiring process, which is certainly the same thing the NFL has said as well, that you've got to have a legitimate open process, not a booster driven process at the college level, not a president driven solo driven process, but there need to be these proper committees. And again, we get another journey we can go on is talk about search firms and the problems that we have with those as well. But Bill, let me ask the last question and any kind of closing thoughts that you got.
Stop the welfare system. I don't know, Fitz. I guess what's your source of optimism? You know, at the end of the day, we've got to be, I guess, optimistic. But what is? I'm assuming that you are somewhat optimistic. I know we've all said we're speechless, but what's your source of optimism that 10 years from now, you know, maybe we'll be seeing more than, you know, 3 out of 65 black coaches in the group of five and more than like, you know, 9 coaches. What's your source of optimism?
Well, I think, you know, I think there is through everything that's happened, there's a new awareness that I think and what Ken is doing from an educational standpoint, that's never been done before. And I'm happy that I'm getting the opportunity to be educated by, you know, his institute. You know, Dr. Labchik Institute is going to take those things to keep this on the front burner. But you've mentioned it, where we are, if you turn on the TV Saturday, when Georgia's playing Alabama, number 2 versus 3 ranked team, Clemson, number 1 team, look at the product out on the field and realize that's our young men growing up, you know, majority African Americans. And so, you know, having their awakening, social media is a huge awakening tool. When you see athletes saying things and being involved, you know, you saw what happened a couple of years ago at University of Missouri. I mean, as you mentioned, when athletes decide to get involved, things will change. And I just think there is an awareness now, you know, from the Black Lives Matter that the social media piece, that something can be shared on social media, you know, whether it's good or bad. All right. It's not saying everything on social media is good. All right. But kids can see it and respond to it, you know, based on their own experiences. And that's why I've said having positive, identifiable role models to be able, those coaches, those high school coaches are invaluable to this process for them to understand how change can take place for equality and inclusion. It comes with the Black student athlete, as it did with San Jose from Tommy out there, the, you know, Speed City, Muhammad Ali. I mean, that's been the process of change. And so as we embrace that, and many times what people say, well, don't mix the politics in with the athletics. I just want to watch the game. Well, you know, it's hard not to when you see people like you oftentimes mistreated and not embraced as a human being.
Well, thank you, Fitz. Bill, you got a final word?
No, I was just saying that was just well said, you know, and I'm glad we ended on a thing of optimism.
Optimism, there we go. See, we're not all bad here.
That's only because I don't want you to get the award. That's, you know. No.
Then you get guilt by association. See?
Yeah, I know. Well, Roden, how come you didn't intervene?
Oh boy. Bill Roden, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, man. And thanks, Fitz. Great seeing you again.
Oh, send me out. Let me know if I can do it. Ken, anytime I can help, just holler at me, okay?
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep. All right.
Once again, that was Ken Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute, Bill Roden, writer at large for The Undefeated, and Fitz Hill, executive director for the Scott Ford Center for Entrepreneurship and Community Development and Foundation at the Arkansas Baptist College. We've put a link to Fitz's book, Crackback, in our show notes. As well, we've also put a link to our Institute's research on head coaching positions at NCAA Power 5 colleges. This episode was produced by me, Andrew Ramsamy. Our manager of marketing and communications is Crisal Valencia. Our manager of events and programs is Kendall Jones. Our marketing and communications assistants are Sage Piccolotti and Julia O'Connell. Our special projects assistant is Katie Cross. To stay up to date on the latest from Global Sport Matters, be sure to follow us on Twitter. We're at Global Sport MTRS. I'm Andrew Ramsamy. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time.